The Crazy Bitches podcast deals with sensitive and potentially triggering material and likely contains adult content and language. Please take care of yourself and any other little ears that are listening.
Any views expressed in this podcast, no matter how brilliant and insightful, are our experiences and opinions only. They are not intended to be taken for medical advice. If you are looking for a diagnosis and/or treatment, please see a medical professional.
You're listening to Crazy Bitches, the weekly podcast where we delve into the scary and sexy world of women's mental health. I'm Amy. I live with borderline personality disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, binge eating disorder. I've recovered from a substance use disorder and from postpartum depression and anxiety.
And I'm Kendra. I live with generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder. I have post-traumatic stress disorder. I have an alcohol use disorder, and I'm in recovery from an eating disorder. And this week, we interviewed someone who has a great name. I love it. Her name is also Kendra. And it's actually not often that I meet someone else by the name of Kendra. So it was a little bit weird interviewing her.
Yeah, so Kendra is an elite athlete. She talks a little bit about that with us in her episode. She's also an advocate for mental health. And she was a challenging guest. Like, she challenged us in the best possible way. She pushed back against us a little bit, which I absolutely love. But it wasn't so easy breezy with her. She made us think.
Yeah, she really did. And what I really loved about her and listening back to her episode, I really liked some of the things that she brought up. And I really loved some of her points about stigma. And I think we talk about stigma a lot. And she really challenged not so much the idea, because stigma absolutely exists in this society. And I don't think that it's not a real thing. But she really challenged the way that when we talk about stigma, often we put the onus on trying to make other people comfortable as opposed to normalizing mental illness by talking about it like it really is. And she had some really good points. The other thing that she really pushed back on is the typo that we made in our email sending it to her.
And she has been diagnosed with OCD, so it only makes sense. Yeah. But she pushed back on this idea of stigma and the fact that we talk about it all the time. And what are we actually doing? And I kind of went, ugh. Like, I guess, like, what am I actually doing? And really, this is us taking action, you and I, but where else am I taking action in my life, right? And it got me thinking. And she practices what she preaches, and that she founded Mentally Fit, which is her foundation, and they are making real, actionable, tangible changes by teaming up with government, schools, the community, hospitals, and she's changing the way that we're responding to mental health in a real, tangible way. And she's really, really cool. And if you want to hear the story about how we embarrassingly told a lesbian to get back in the closet, please stick around and listen, because she did not let us off the hook for that one. So enjoy, Kendra.
So about the stalking you on Facebook, it was funny because I said, oh, we're going to need to research her. And Amy just jokingly said, okay, I'm going to look her up on Wikipedia. And she wasn't just going to look you up on Wikipedia. But I said, no, don't look her up on Wikipedia. Because I had recently heard a comedian do a bit about how he liked to go in and change all of his Wikipedia information to fuck with people. And I have this dream of one day being notorious enough to have a Wikipedia page so that I can just go in and change all my information all the time.
Can you do that?
You can. Yeah, anyone can edit Wikipedia. So you can go in, and I encourage you to do this, and just change anything you want on Wikipedia. Like, anyone in the world can edit Wikipedia.
That's so terrifying. Do I have a Wikipedia page?
Yes, you do.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I should find out who edited it last.
Or who wrote it? Like, who took it upon themselves to write your bio on the internet?
Hmm. I try not to think about that.
Well, you have generalized anxiety disorder, correct?
I have all the disorders.
Yeah. So do we. Yeah. And I've got GAD as well. So does Kendra. But I've had to learn to completely let some things go in order to survive. Like, there's certain things that I just cannot allow myself to worry about. Like, is my daughter eating enough vegetables? Like, yes, I feed her vegetables, but I know that if I start going down that path, I will drive myself into madness. So
she's probably going to get scurvy, actually, just to give you a heads up, because you're probably not giving her enough vegetables.
Do you know what's hilarious is I actually tell my children that they're getting scurvy to get eat enough vegetables. Yeah, I've shown them. So this is horrible. But I actually have on the internet looked up scurvy and shown them pictures of scurvy teeth to scare them into eating enough vegetables. So now I tell them, like, you're going to need to eat this vegetable. And they refuse. And I say, well, I guess you're just going to get scurvy, and they will eat that vegetable because they are terrified. Yeah. That's I'm not amazing. Saying that that's effective parenting, encourage anyone to do it, but it has worked.
I feel like I could point you in the direction of a few parenting quote unquote experts that would probably suggest that that's not the best tactic, but I also am not going to pretend to know what's best. I was joking so much that it took the entirety of her story there for me to actually remember the word scurvy. So I love that you actually use that. That's incredible.
So you're in Ontario, right, Kendra?
I am, yes.
Yeah, and you're from there?
I am. I'm from a town that, unless you're from a very specific area in Ontario, you've never heard of. I'm from Kincardine, Ontario. And it is, for those of you on the West Coast, let's say 3 hours west of Toronto, right on Lake Huron.
Was it a hockey town?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a lakeside community that during the winter, it's hockey. During the summer now, we've actually got quite the surf community. So it's a cool little town.
So I saw in one of your blog posts, you talking about seeing your brother on ice when he was 4, or when you were 4. So it's always been hockey for you and Team Canada.
Oh, you did your research,
the goal.
Yeah. I mean, I was 4, and if we're going to tell that story honestly, I was standing there watching my brother play hockey, and I actually turned and made the comment to my folks that when I grew up to be a boy, I wanted to play hockey like my brother. Mm-hmm. And that was the year I started. By 6 years old, I was playing rep hockey. And I think pretty early on, I knew I wanted hockey to be my life. And then as women's hockey kind of came into the picture and onto the scene, I knew I wanted the Olympics.
So you were a pretty driven child then, because you have to have a certain amount of drive to be competitive in sports, right?
I think it just came so naturally that I didn't even feel driven. It was just, I loved to play sports. I was always drawn to it. I played hockey competitively. I played tennis competitively. I played baseball and softball competitively. And then I played every school sport you could imagine. So I liked to be busy. I liked to play sports. I liked the teammates and the camaraderie of it. I loved everything about it.
And how did you do in school?
That's not nice. why you gotta go there? I actually was an above average student. I did well in school. I was by no means at the top of the class, but I did very well in classes I enjoyed and I liked. I did okay at classes that weren't necessarily my greatest interests.
You alluded to that there were signs of maybe something being off or behaviors into childhood. I'm wondering if you could walk us through that.
So for me, I guess it kind of started after high school. I got into a car accident and I actually fractured a vertebrae in my back. And I think it was the first time in my life that I was kind of stopped from doing what I naturally did to support my mental health. So I wasn't able to be on the ice every day. I wasn't working out every day. I wasn't out being active. I was kind of laid up. And so I kind of got through that process of recovering from my physical injury. And all of a sudden I started feeling all these other symptoms and felt like I was having a heart attack and I felt like I couldn't breathe and felt like I was going to pass out. So I ended up in the emergency room a few times because that's what you do when you're having a heart attack. You go to the ER. And then it kind of just kept compounding. And I went to my doctor and explained it to my doctor. And she did what every other doctor does and sent me to 5 other specialists. And I ended up getting a clean bill of health from everybody you could imagine. I had a neurologist, I had a cardiologist, I had a gastrointestinal specialist. Every single one of them telling me how healthy I was, which was, I mean, obviously great, until symptomatically I couldn't handle it anymore. I mean, every day I was in crisis. So then nobody could give me answers. So I started trying to manage it myself. I realized the one day that I went out partying with some friends that it wasn't as intense. So I kept partying. I kept drinking. I kept doing anything I could to numb it. And eventually you can imagine where that led. And I got to a point where the timing was horrible because I had tryouts for Team Canada and I had to fly out to Calgary for a 2-week tryout. And I got out there and I mean, I look at it now and aside from the symptoms, I've also now I'm forced into not using anything that I've been using to manage these feelings. I couldn't drink when I was out there. I couldn't hide from people. I couldn't hide what I was feeling. And it just came to a head. And The next day I pulled the coaches aside, tried to explain to them what had been going on and what was happening, that I'd been to the doctors and the specialists. Nobody could tell me what was wrong, but I couldn't function anymore. And they told me I made Team Canada.
Wow.
It's obviously one of the most memorable moments of my life, but I'd rather forget it because it didn't matter. I couldn't be there. I couldn't stay. And that was the day I quit Team Canada. And I left that next day and started what became a journey of getting diagnosed. And I mean, yes, generalized anxiety disorder, but coupled with severe panic disorder, severe panic attacks, agoraphobia, OCD, and clinical depression. And it was just this sentence that somebody handed me in the middle of my life and said, here, everything's about to change. And I became a shell of myself. I couldn't leave my apartment. I couldn't be alone. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I was in panic attacks 6 to 8 hours a day. I was done. Couldn't function anymore. And that's really what it took for me to start getting help. And then I don't think it was even until probably I spent 5 years in that state of just the only thing I did was play hockey. I was basically given the choice by my doctors and my psychologist and my parents. And they basically said, you're not going to lay down and die. You keep one commitment. We don't care what it is, whether you want to go to school, whether you want to work, whether you want to keep playing hockey, whatever it is, you pick one thing.
So how did you go? Because at this point, it sounds like you were convinced that this was something physically going on in your body. And I can totally understand that because I myself went through a long period of really believing that I had something wrong with me. Like I would go to the hospital having heart palpitations and think that I was similar to you having a heart attack. And at a couple of points, it was suggested to me like maybe this is anxiety, but I was so convinced that no, I can feel this so physically in my body that I'm having a heart attack. Get out of here with that, you know, anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I as well was referred to a cardiologist and it didn't cross my mind that this was anything psychological because I could feel it so physically that the idea that it was in my mind, just, I couldn't fathom that. So how did it come to be that after you were sent home from Team Canada, how did it go from you believing that this was something physical to getting these mental health diagnoses?
Well, I mean, first off, to play devil's advocate, because that's what I do. We talk about these things like they're separate issues. The bottom line is when you're having a panic attack, the physiological and biological effects of it are real. And so as much as it is, quote unquote, just a panic attack, the biological effects can have some pretty serious repercussions as well. It is a real feeling. You can put a heart monitor on me. You can put a blood pressure cuff on me. You can, using those kind of key vitals that they use, you know, you can see the elevations. And so that physical feeling becomes just as real as the mental side of things. But I was fortunate. I mean, I'm lucky because where I made it to in hockey afforded me access to help pretty quickly. And so 5 days after I quit Team Canada, they put me in touch with a doctor is how it started. And when they told me they wanted to hook me up with a doctor, I just remember being excited. You know, Team Canada's got to have good doctors. Somebody's finally going to figure out what's wrong with me and we're going to get on with my life here. Still very much at that point convinced that this was a physical illness. And then they told me it was a sports psychologist. And I just...
Rude.
I just remember being pissed. I was offended. Yeah. I was like, I don't need a shrink. Like, this is, you know, I'm dying. My heart's, there's something wrong. Like, why are you sending me to a shrink? And then just as quickly, I mean, whatever rational thought I had left kicked in and said, you know, if Team Canada needs to hear from a psychologist that that's offside, that that's not the problem here, then that's what I got to do. I got to go, because ultimately, if I can get back to Team Canada, that's what I want. So I went, and I was horrible. I was a really horrible patient. How? How did I go from making Team Canada to sitting in my psychologist's chair going, what are you talking about? And very quickly, I was diagnosed. And I agreed to participate. I would say that's about as much as I gave it was my participation. I showed up. I sat and listened when she talked to me, but I didn't know what to do. You know, I was prescribed some medication. I agreed to go back and see my psychologist, and I just kind of went through the motions of it. I went through showing up for 5 years, and for 5 years, that's all I did was show up. I didn't buy into it. I was not a good patient. I was an athlete. I was untouchable. I was a Team Canada level goaltender who, you know, all of a sudden I couldn't spend 2 minutes alone. If you were my friend, you were sitting with me on my couch, my living room, and you had to go pee, I'd follow you down the hall. I'd sit on the floor outside the bathroom, because if you left me alone that long, I was convinced I'd be dead. And yeah. I was terrified. So yeah, it was a good 5 years before I finally accepted what they were telling me.
So you didn't agree with the diagnosis?
Didn't agree, didn't have rational thought enough to process it. I wasn't on the right meds. Stubborn. I'm very stubborn. I was stubborn. I was proud. I was denying it. I couldn't explain it. I went from what felt like on top of the world to hiding in my apartment, terrified to let anybody know what was going on with me. And I just kind of disappeared from the world. And I didn't want to share that reality with anybody. So I didn't acknowledge it. You know, after 5 years, I remember waking up one morning and I just didn't see a point anymore. I didn't want that life. I didn't want to be there anymore. And I just remember thinking in that moment, either give up and quit and get this over with because I can't do this anymore, or do something about it. And I don't know where I found it that day, but I made my way back to my doctors and found out that horrible fact that meds for mental health don't work the same for everybody, and found out that I wasn't on the ideal med for me for 5 years. So got on the journey of finding the right meds. And once I did, it was a huge turning point for me. I got to a place where kind of all the extremes went away. The extreme panic, the extreme anxiety, the extreme depression, the extreme OCD. And I got to a place where I could learn about what they were telling me I was living with. And all of a sudden, I actually start to understand my diagnosis. And I started to understand what it meant and what I had to do. And to go back to your question before, I'd say that was really the first time that I had enough kind of presence of mind to realize that I could have been diagnosed when I was 5 years old, because some of those behaviors and some of those disordered thoughts, now that I understood it, now that I was able to participate in my recovery, I realized I'd been living with some degree of this my whole life.
I believe it was about 10 years ago you were interviewed by a young hockey player, and I was listening to that interview and there was a lot of things that struck me about it, and that's why I'd asked you about how you did in school. There's something about your story that really resonated with me, because it seems to me like you are one of those people that is just so high functioning, like you have that type of high functioning anxiety, that kind of perfectionistic anxiety. And I think it really hit me when you were talking about how after you had to quit Team Canada, that kind of shame you felt and how you didn't want to talk to anybody about it. And I mean, there's not a lot of people in this world who could do what you did. And it takes a lot of drive and a lot of ambition. And I think a lot of people with anxiety, it serves them, right? Like there's some things that I'm not going to say healthy. I mean, anxiety is not healthy, but there's a certain amount of anxiety that you need almost to get to be successful. I mean, your anxiety probably served you to a certain point to get to the high level of achievement that you did. But then when it gets to a point of excess, then it can sometimes cripple you. And I could be completely wrong here, but were you a kind of a perfectionist, overachieving type of child?
Shockingly, no. So really? I understand what you're saying. And in certain parts of my life, absolutely, it's true. But when my anxiety became excessive, when my panic became excessive, I was non-functioning. I could bullshit my way through the 3 hours that I was at the arena. But if you saw me trying to get to the arena, or you saw me once I left the arena, it was crippling. It would take me probably, at my worst, it would take me almost 3 hours to get to the arena, just because I would pull over so many times on the way, convinced I was dying. And I would get there and it would exhaust me to get through it. But it was almost like when I was on the ice in my net, it was almost meditative. It was almost mindful. It was my safe space. When I was younger, it wasn't that I was a perfectionist. I was just busy. But when I look back and I think about the behaviors and the disordered thought and everything, you know, it was the fears. It was the irrational, terrified my parents were going to die. I couldn't sleep over at people's houses. I was terrified of being away from home. I was terrified of being away from home because I was terrified that, you know, something would happen to my parents. Or I don't know if you had a chance. I wrote an article with the Players Tribune a few years back, and I spoke about, I don't know if you've ever heard of that kind of typical childhood prayer that many people used to say, "Now I lay me down to sleep."
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And there's the one line in it, "If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take." Mm-hmm. And I used to fixate on that. I had such a phobia of going to sleep because I was going to wake up and somebody was going to be gone. And it just manifested throughout my life. I mean, even as an adult, for the longest time, I would literally have to call my parents every night, and they didn't even know it. They didn't know that I was walking them through this script in my head, but I would say, "I'll talk to you tomorrow." And if they said, "Okay," I'd have to say it again. And if they said, "Sure," I'd have to say it again. I needed to hear yes. I needed to hear, "Yeah, you'll talk to me tomorrow." It was like this contract they were signing without even realizing it. And I, you know, I couldn't appease it until I heard it. And there's so many points in my life that I can go back and kind of see that level of fear and fixation on fear.
I find it pretty interesting that you found peace with having pucks flinged at you purposely.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that would give me a lot of anxiety. I found that really interesting. But
it's my fallback, right? They all goalies are crazy. So I figure I've got a clear pass in life for pretty much anything, you know, between my diagnosis and the fact that I'm a goalie. And if we want to bring hair color into it as well, I mean, you really can't pin anything on me.
My son is going through that fear of death, and he's constantly really upset about me dying. He's always bringing it up. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, I don't know what to say to him because I am going to die. Not now, but at some point. And I just can feel for you and I can feel for him. And I don't know what to say with that fear because I remember being a little kid and having fears like that. And
I'll be honest with you. I mean, you asked me, you know, are there signs to look for? And, you know, that level of commitment to fear, that level of commitment to worry is a sign. I'm not sitting here diagnosing your son, but...
Oh, no. I mean, he is anxious.
I'll tell you what, if that were something in my house, that's something to look into. And it's something to find out because I dropped it in this kind of 10 minutes ago when we met before the show that we lost a son. And it's weird because it's brought this into a whole new perspective for me. Mm-hmm. It was about 2 years ago now, and my wife was 32 weeks along, and it was horrific. It was a 3-day delivery. Everything that could have went wrong went wrong. It was horrible. And at that time, my son was 2. And so my 2-year-old is at home with my mother and just kind of, where did mommy and mama go? You know, we went to the hospital. He understood that he was going to have a baby. At that time, we didn't know brother. And he knew enough, right? And we never really know how to gauge what kids understand and what their perspective is or their focus is. So we went, and one of the first things we questioned when we got to the hospital was, how do we deal with this with our 2-year-old? We had somebody come speak to us in the hospital almost right away. And it was one of the first questions we asked her. And she said, be honest with him. And we said, what do you mean? What does that mean? How honest can you be with a 2-year-old? And she said, be honest, you know, let him know that his baby brother died. Let him know that he's now in heaven, if that's your belief system, but let him know what's happened. Let him experience that however that's going to look for him, but don't deprive him that, and just use honest language. And it was horrific. I mean, you don't want to go back to your 2-year-old and have a conversation about death, but we did. And since that day, he's now 4.5, and we've watched him go through the progression of grieving the loss of his baby brother. And it's changed over time. It's gone from just an innocent comment to questions about death, to questions about heaven, to comments that are terrifying, because then it's like, I can't wait to go to heaven and meet River. And you're just like, oh my gosh, no, what have we done? To just the perspective comments, like you'll be sitting there one day and he's like, you know, I want to go to the cemetery and say hi to River. And it catches you off guard. And there's days where it knocks you on your ass because it's not a day you want to deal with it. But there's so much to be said for having honest conversation with kids. And it was beyond me until that. So, I mean, when our kids start to experience and convey those fears and those worries, mm-hmm. there's so much to be said about just being honest with them and feeling that hurt and that worry and that pain with them. Because
even if we don't speak it in words, kids speak the language of vibration and our energy and emotion so clearly, and they pick up on that regardless. And then certainly, to not have a explanation attached to that, it would be a very invalidating, scary experience.
It's how we handle mental health to a lot of degrees as well, because a lot of people, it's uncomfortable and we shy away from uncomfortable discussions. And so I always encourage it now because I look back at what I went through and I look back at how I stay in recovery. And a lot of it has to do with just being blatantly honest.
Yeah, that's what we're doing here. Blatantly. Like the women that share on this show have said some things that it's like that inside voice stuff that you're not supposed to say out loud. And we give it the space here. And it's so powerful. And sometimes even for us being two women, Kendra and I, that really are passionate about this and passionate about talking about mental health, sometimes it'll even take us aback because we're not used to hearing that level of honesty. And it is so beautiful. And the people that show up to listen to this, it takes courage to listen as well as to share, right? And certainly, I'm wondering if you experience stigma around this.
I hate that word, just so you know. I'll tell you up front, I hate the word stigma.
Tell us why.
Because every time we talk about stigma, it's talk. How can we talk about stigma? Well, I guess because I've been involved in this journey for so long and the space that I fit in now in terms of what I do within mental health and the realm of trying to support others, it's all action-based. As far as I'm concerned, you know, we can try to make it easier to hear. We can try to simplify our language. We can try to find that glass half full approach, or we can talk about it like it's terrifying and it's a crisis and it's horrible and it absolutely ends in tragedy sometimes. And it affects people's lives with such an entirety and completeness in a way that so many people don't understand that it's devastating. And when we talk about stigma, we have this belief system that we have to make it easier for others to accept. Well, we take away some of that rawness. We take away some of that authenticity. Mental health issues didn't almost kill me. Mental illness did. And I don't need somebody to tell me that we're having conversation about mental health. You know, we could talk about mental illness. It's okay. There's actually an illness component to this. And I just find that when we start trying to tiptoe around language and we start trying to make it okay enough for other people to not be so uncomfortable with it, mm-hmm. it almost takes away from the experience of those who are living with it. Because I can assure you that if you go up to somebody who's experiencing some level of crisis, whether it's depression, bipolar disorder, any of the personality disorders, and you try to make it pretty for them, there's nothing pretty. It's messy.
I live with a personality disorder and I recently was officially diagnosed last summer and I lost my job due to COVID, like so many of us did. And I found that that was the one glue that was holding me together. And I went into what I can only describe as a mental illness crisis and I crumbled. But yeah, it is messy. And one of the guests we had on recently, she has a podcast as well. And she talks about how ending this idea that we have about mental health around personality disorders too is not mm-hmm. saying that you need to accept this or you need to feel a certain way about it. It is painful. No. It is hard. And your experience as well is very valid.
But it's that action piece, right? It's really allowing people to experience it instead of trying to have them experience in a way that we feel comfortable with it. And I think that that's where I struggle because a lot of the conversation around the stigma of mental health is let's not talk negatively about it because that makes it harder for people who are living with it. When in fact, to me, you make it harder for me to live with it when you make me feel like I should be ashamed of the fact that it is messy and it is real and it did take away a lot of really incredible things in my life. And it's not something that I need you to make softer. And I really find that there's this inherent need to make things okay for others. And I understand, like, trust me, I get the notion of stigma and I understand that it does cause barriers and it does cause challenges for people. I'm not ignorant to that. But I guess we're so far along in talking about stigma. I mean, how long now has Belle Let's Talk been in existence? We've been talking about stigma for years now. The piece that we're still missing is, are there enough safe spaces across this country where people can honestly stand up and feel they are safe and saying, I'm not okay right now?
Right. Yeah. And it's okay to say, I'm not okay, to speak your truth.
Well, and in all honesty, too, it's okay to say, I have no clue what to do with that, but I'm here. And that's the piece that I feel like people who understand the experience of it can help to educate others with. If I go up to somebody, if I go up to a friend, if I go up to a family member and I'm having a horrible day, I don't need you to be my doctor. I don't need you to be my shrink. I don't need you to fix it. But if I come up to you and I say, look, I'm not okay and I don't want to be alone right now, fill that space with me. And so many people kind of kick into the, I know how to fix this for you, that it feels like you're facing somebody just trying to brush you off. And there's this middle ground where we can exist in pain together. We can exist in discomfort together. We can have those awkward conversations and still have it be okay.
Well, that's one thing we really wanted to do with this podcast is we wanted to make it very clear that we're not experts. We're not putting this up here. We're not having people come on with their stories to say, I went through this mental health crisis, or this is my mental health story, and these are the solutions that I have for you. We're not trying to have people say, or experts come on and say, if you have generalized anxiety disorder, here are some tips to make it better. That's not the point here. We're wanting women to come on and share their stories and say, hey, I have this disorder. I have a generalized anxiety disorder and it fucking sucks. Yeah. And this is what I live with. And I don't have any solutions for you. It's messy. Some days are better than others, but, and this is my story. And we're not doctors. We have more questions than answers. But if you live with the same condition I do, then here's some solidarity for you. And I think that's what's missing out there a lot of the times, is just realizing that this is normal. I'm not alone. Because a lot of people live out there in shame, in that really dark space, and just feeling like they're worthless. And I lived like that for so long, and just feeling like I couldn't tell anybody because they would judge me. And I think just more people out there just saying, like, I have this, I live with this, would just make such a difference.
That lived experience is in itself a form of support that is proven. Peer support is one of the most effective ways to live with mental illness, and to find a coping strategy or resource in mental health is through peer support. And that takes lived experience.
And really, women like you, I mean, I can get out there and I can tell my story, but to have somebody who is a high-level athlete, a lot of people know who you are. If somebody like you has lived with something like this and gotten through it and is thriving, that just makes a big difference. You're a role model to many women. And
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, there's going to be young girls who will look up to you and say, like, wow, I would have never known. Like, if you're quiet about something like this, that's fine. And that's your prerogative. And not everybody is obligated to share their story. But when you do, it's just so powerful, because your visibility means that it just will give so many other people hope.
On that note, I am curious of how you still struggle today. I know that you've talked about medication. Medication, someone put it so perfectly, I was drowning and medication gave me the ability to tread water. So I'm wondering what you're left with. What does that treading water sometimes feel like for you?
Well, when I talk about medication, I obviously, sports analogies are always the easiest for me. And you're right, it didn't cure me. It killed the extremes. And it gave me this ability to start to learn. I mean, what people cease to realize is that when somebody is living with mental illness, when they're in the throes of their disorder and they aren't stable, that ability to have rational thought, that ability to learn, it becomes non-existent. And so that medication really kind of acted like a cast for me. You break your leg, you know enough to put a cast on your leg to get it fixed before you try to make it stronger. And so medication was that same kind of piece. It got me to a place where there weren't so many breaks in me that I couldn't start working on making it better. And for me personally, I mean, my psychologist is a godsend. my psychologist, talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy became really the foundation that allowed me to keep building. It was learning to process what I was feeling, how my body was responding to it. It was the process of learning how to have my behaviors reflect my thoughts instead of how I was feeling. And once I kind of started to get good at that, she started getting really crazy and suggesting things like yoga. And I was like, nah, like, I'm a hockey player. I'm not doing yoga. My biggest problem was I started it like an athlete. So You get in there and the yoga instructor's like, okay, like start in this pose. And if you're comfortable with this pose, push it to this. And, you know, if you're comfortable with that, push to this. So I go in there like an athlete and I'm like, sure, yeah, I can do the hardest pose possible.
110% every day.
Yeah. 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 I couldn't walk for 3 days after.
No, because you're not as flexible as you think you are, right? When you
I'm a goalie, like, so I had that going for me.
Oh, that's true.
I wasn't at all prepared for that. But
no,
what yoga became for me and what yoga did for me was it taught me how to breathe. And then I remember the one day I really learned how to control my breathing. And I started to have a panic attack. And I remember, like, I just remember starting that breathing and getting my panic attack under control, and I hit my knees and I just cried. I bawled. I sobbed. I had never in my life experienced that level of relief. And it wasn't until that moment that I realized how much I'd been through. It wasn't until that moment that I realized how much my body had been through in existing at that level of anxiety and fear and panic for so long. And that was the moment I just got obsessed. Like, I wanted to know absolutely everything I could. If you had a suggestion, I was going to try it. So my psychologist was also huge on physical fitness, great for mental health. Well, I'm an athlete. I've been training since I was 4. So somebody's misdiagnosed me along the way, if that's what cures mental illness. But I learned that there was this like huge difference between training to be an okay goalie versus doing cardio every day for the purpose of mental health. Then I started to build this routine, and it was, you know, talk therapy, CBT, yoga, physical fitness. And then somebody suggested nutrition. And I'm like, okay, that's an easy one. Let's go. Wrote down everything I ate for 2 weeks. And at that point, learned probably one of the hardest lessons I've learned in this journey, which was that sugar is horrible for mental illness.
Damn it.
Shit. Well, like, you don't ever have a bad day and ask somebody to bring you a carrot. Like, it's just,
no.
That's just not how it works.
So. And you probably never watched your diet before either, right? Because you've been performing at this high level of like athleticism. So you don't have to worry about your weight.
Well,
so you probably just eat what you want. Carb load, right?
I certainly ate a lot of sugar. I ate a lot of ice cream. I have a problem with ice cream. And so I realized that and made some kind of tweaks in my diet that really changed my moods and my energy level. And then somebody suggests a naturopath and I'm sitting there thinking, hugging trees and eating leaves, it's not going to cure the world here. But learned more about naturopaths and then took a chance and found some supplements and vitamins that essentially made the side effects of my antidepressants go away. And just got to a place where I felt awesome. I know that if I'm not complacent and I stick with this routine, for the most part, my day-to-day life is not affected by my mental illness. And I've spent so many years now mastering that routine and engaging in that routine that, you know, outside of specific fears and specific phobias, which I live with emetophobia. I don't know if you know what that is, but I...
No, tell us.
Yeah. So it's a fun one, especially for moms out there. I have a severe fear of vomit.
Oh my God. This is so funny because we had a guest on a little while ago that had the exact same phobia. And
it's the sixth most common phobia in the world, believe it or not.
So funny.
Controls everything.
And yes. So, especially if you're a mom. Yeah.
Well, and so, yeah. Go figure. And here's my testament to exposure therapy. So it's not a pretty story. So
you went to a frat party?
No, worse. You know, we decided we were going to have kids and I'm sitting there thinking this is great. And then I thought, oh my God, kids throw up.
All the time.
So I'm kind of thinking precautionary. I'm going to have to deal with this because if I'm ever holding a kid that throws up, it's probably neglectful to throw them. So, yeah.
Frowned upon.
I would have. At one point in my life, I would have. I didn't hold my nephew till he was one for this very reason. So I did the responsible thing. I signed up for a phobia program. I signed up for a program at CAMH, and we all know that wait lists are a thing when it comes to mental health resources. So I'm on this wait list to go to this phobia program, and I'm starting it 3 months after my first son was to be born. And I'm thinking, that's okay. 3 months, I can deal with 3 months. I'm going to deal with this. I'm terrified. This is like worst possible case scenario, because any phobia-based program is an exposure therapy program. Yeah. Well, what are they going to do? Like, are you going to make me play with puke? Are you going to make me stick my fingers down my throat? Like, I don't want to know what this looks like, right? Mm-hmm. I'm terrified. I'm getting myself all worked up. We have our first son. Our first son has reflux.
Oh, God.
I'm talking like 25, 30 projectile vomits a day. Like, I'm talking exorcist. Like, it was ridiculous. So by the time this phobia program rolls around, I don't need it anymore, because I've been dealing with the actual thing for so long now that I'm kind of like okay with it. Yeah, so I'm a big fan of exposure therapy. So then as life went on, I just kind of stick with it now. And I'm at a place now where if I stick with my routine, I eat well, I have to run every day. And if I'm not running, I've got to be doing some type of a high intensity workout. I got to get my heart rate up every day. I practice mindfulness, I write, I engage in talk therapy, I practice CBT, and I'm a huge fan of exposure therapy. And then I became a firefighter, so it was just kind of like every single possible thing you could ever be faced with in life, all every shift. So, yeah.
You make it sound kind of easy, like I just have to do this and I just have to do that. But I mean, it is a lot of stuff. And there's a lot of stuff I have to do for my mental health as well. And I'm sure Amy. But if you think about it, we have to do a lot of work to keep our mental health in check. I mean, I do DBT.
Absolutely.
I try to eat well. And it is a big commitment. And like what you say about the physical and the eating well. And I also, when I was younger, suffered from an eating disorder. So I have to work out. But at the same time, if I work out too much or there's certain type of exercises that will trigger me, right? Like, so I have to make sure it's not obsessive. So like, for example, I do Legree, so it's not too intense because I know that I can get obsessive about things. And same with the eating healthy. I can't follow any diet that's too restrictive. I try to eat well, but I can't like ever count calories. I can't weigh myself. Yeah. I can't. So there's such a balance that I have to find. And so as much as you say, oh, I just do this and this and this, like it's a lot of stuff, right? And I don't think people appreciate it that when you have a mental health condition, we have to make sure that we're doing a lot of things. It's exhausting when we are high anxiety all the time, because panic attacks and anxiety are extremely exhausting for the physical body. But it's also somewhat exhausting to make sure that we're checking all the boxes to make sure that our mental health is in check all the time too. So there's a lot that we do have to do to keep mentally well as well. And we kind of laugh about it, right? But at the same time, it is very important. And I'm lucky, and it sounds like you're lucky as well. Your spouse is quite understanding to make sure that they allow space to do those things. But it can be quite time consuming. And when I let some of those things go by the wayside, I can really feel it. Like I can be more impatient with my children. So I just want to point out to whoever's listening that it does take a lot of work, and it also to find the right routine.
Well, and that's the thing, right? I mean, we're trying to fit my 20 years of life experience post-diagnosis into an hour. I mean, you think with ease, obviously. It is a routine, and I'll be honest with you, and I'll put a disclaimer in front of this. I received a solid diagnosis 11 years ago. It's been so many ups and downs learning that routine, but then it's also making those decisions that you are confident in, because in reality, yes, you have a supportive partner, but your partner's going to have to be even more engaged if you are not healthy and if you are not well. And I hear it all the time, and it frustrates me to no end, because everybody will sit there and say, well, you know, I got to work out and I got to eat well, and I got to get enough sleep, and I've got to engage in talk therapy, and I've got to do this. Well, in reality, all we are doing, and it sucks, trust me, it sucks, but all it means is we don't get away with being lazy. We don't get away with being complacent, and we have to engage in an overall routine of wellness. But it benefits both mental and physical health. In reality, my routine is the ideal routine for anybody, minus my medications. I'll argue that look at this pandemic right now. There's so many people out there who have never experienced mental illness in their life, who have never had any challenges to their mental health, who all of a sudden are learning all of these things for the first time. And
of course,
it's really had an impact on people and the way we perceive how we use our time. And I challenge those people who say, it's tough, I don't have time. First piece of advice I have to anybody who says I don't have time, go pick up your phone, take a look at your time usage in your day. Mm-hmm. And if you spent half an hour on social media, you have time.
I feel personally attacked right now, Kendra.
I know. I was just going to say, I'm kind of laughing to myself because I'm wondering what her definition of lazy is versus mine. Like the woman who plays social media. 12 in high school. She's like, you're lazy. I went for a 20-mile run this morning. Like, what did you do?
I don't want to talk about my phone statistics, okay?
I know.
But, you know, no, but I'm guilty of it too. Yeah, every time I talk about this stuff, it's all pointing inward. If you're taking it personally, that's your prerogative.
Yeah. It's
but
a joke.
But this is how I measure myself, right? You know, I'm sitting here talking about my routine. My routine's not going to work for everybody. So we each have to define what that looks like for ourselves. You know, I heard that quote once, and I guess it just stuck with me, which was make time for your health or make time to be sick.
Yeah. Can you tell us about Mentally Fit and some examples of how you practice that action piece in your life?
Yeah. So Mentally Fit started actually just as kind of a hashtag for me. I was listening to somebody speak 10 years after I had left Team Canada, and he just happened to be the sports psychologist for Team Canada at the time. And he was talking about being mentally fit. And it made sense to me because it broke down kind of dealing with my mental health into a functional way. That's just how I work. I'm very functional in the sense of I want something to do to try to make it better. And so I remember after I heard him talk, I walked up to him and I was like, I really love that whole mentally fit thing. And he's like, you know, it's never caught on, so take it. And I was like, okay, I'll take it. So Mentally Fit was born from this idea of action, showing up and having kind of this practice of caring for ourselves and caring for one another. So set that notion aside for 1 second. A couple of years ago, I was driving home to Kincardine from Toronto, and I was in this stretch of the middle of nowhere country. And I think I was, 38 at the time. And I ran out of gas, as every responsible 38-year-old does, speaking of my laziness. I remember sitting there thinking, I don't remember how this works in the country. Like, you're in Toronto, you call CAA or you flag down a tow truck. Like, there's no troubles figuring out what to do if you're having a quote unquote car trouble. I'm in this little like middle of nowhere place going, I'm going to be late for a speaking engagement and I need gas and I don't know what to do. So instead of calling the tow truck, I went onto my Facebook page and I have a decent following on my Facebook platform. So I typed into Facebook, is there anybody near Mild May right now who has 15 minutes to spare and wants to be my hero? That's all I put. I'm sitting there thinking, nobody's going to answer this because they're going to think I'm in crisis and everybody's going to run as far away from this post as they can. But let's see what happens. And within 15 minutes, I had 22 responses and I had somebody standing next to my car with a jerry can of gas. And I thought to myself, how incredibly powerful that moment was, because without even having a clue what I needed, without knowing what was wrong, without knowing anything, 22 people were willing to give their time to me and offer to help. And so I took that and I kind of thought to myself, you know what? For the most part, people do want to support one another. They're just not sure how to do it. And for the most part, if we created a safe enough place for somebody to feel comfortable saying, I need help, it gives a very different directive to it. And so the whole notion of Mentally Fit and our community programming was born from this moment in just creating a safe place within communities for people to say, I'm not okay, and giving people the opportunity to show up for one another. So we built an entire program on 4 pillars, which was, it's very cyclical. So basically we provide assist training, which is applied suicide intervention training, for the purpose of being able to teach people how to communicate with somebody in crisis. And really our sole purpose of this was, let's create more confident communicators in every single facet where people could end up in crisis. Mm. So that stood as one pillar. The second part of it was we created a program kind of based on the Neighborhood Watch program, creating just safe spaces all over towns. So if you go into rural communities and you look at public businesses, we started putting up Mentally Fit stickers. And in order to have a Mentally Fit sticker on your door, basically you had to agree that if somebody walked in and mentioned the sticker on their door, you would sit with that individual and you would reach out to a crisis hotline in that area for that person. It was essentially a way to take the responsibility of reaching out for help from somebody in crisis and a way to make sure they weren't alone while they waited. So hopefully making sure somebody's not alone at the moment that is most dangerous for them. Our hospital program was about to launch and COVID happened, but essentially what we were doing was building a safe space in hospitals that didn't operate on the same physical algorithm as the emergency room. So instead of showing up at the hospital, having a panic attack and being set aside for 9 hours and not dealt with because you're not emergent, you're not close to death as per the protocol of emergency response. Instead, let's put that person in a supportive environment and contact resources within the community that can act as peer support until they receive help. Because so many people end up in the emergency room and feel so unseen and feel so cast aside and it never de-escalates. You leave in further crisis. It changes that kind of experience and hopefully limits your response to feel like you need emergent care and instead puts you into a community where resources are available and you are now known to need those resources. And then lastly, we started something called a community resource program, which essentially builds the infrastructure for a mental health support system using existing infrastructure. So it's essentially costless. You know, we just talked a lot about the things that you have to do to maintain good mental health. You know, we talk about things like fitness and yoga and mindfulness, meditation, nutrition, talk therapy, so on and so forth. Well, if you think about every community, every city, every rural community, those things exist already. We just don't know to utilize them as mental health supports. We don't have gyms that are there for the purpose of cardio for anxiety, or we don't have gyms that are there for the purpose of facilitating a fitness class for people with eating disorders to make sure it doesn't become obsessive. We don't have nutritionists out there who are solely practicing for the purpose of, you know, a low processed food, a low sugar diet to support better mental health. So essentially what we do is we go into a community and we educate those providers on how they could be a mental health support. And then we invite them to be a part of the mentally fit community. And essentially to be a part of the community, you have to commit to volunteering 1 hour of service once a month. So if you're a gym in Kincardine, Ontario, and you want to be part of the mentally fit community, which from a business perspective means you're getting free marketing on a huge platform, you essentially have to volunteer 1 hour a month. That's it. It costs you nothing. It's a service you already provide and overhead you already cover. And you're going to use that 1 hour to offer a class or a service to whomever it is that signs up for it. And it's going to be geared towards mental health. So essentially what you do is you create an infrastructure of 30 mental health resources within 30 kilometers of every person's house every night of the week for a full month, just by getting 30 providers to sign into this program, which is quite simple. And then it just becomes cyclical because now you've got public safe places that are supported by people who are trained, which facilitates transition into a hospital that is then supported by community resources because you're educating them at the hospital about all of the other resources they could utilize in the community. The Mentally Fit programming right now was only launched as a pilot in 3 rural communities, Ontario. We're currently discussing and trying to launch this province-wide, but it's a program that could be launched nationally with ease. I mean, essentially at this point, it's a box solution program that could be implemented in any rural community as long as there's a group of people in that community that want to lead it.
Wow. Wow, that's just amazing. It sounds like you guys are doing some really amazing work.
You know what? It's super cool. Yes, I understand that some of the brain power behind it is mine, but the best part of it is watching communities adopt it. Because in reality, you know, it's really just about showing up for each other. I have so little to do with it other than to offer a platform for it to happen. So my Facebook page, over these isolation periods, I unfortunately am aware of suicide rates and the increase, and I'm aware of the increase of kind of overdose and opioids deaths. And so when the second isolation in Ontario was launched, right away I said, you know what, I'll be there every day. Every day I'll show up. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I'll be there. I want you to know you're not alone. And every day it's so cool because people are so grateful that I show up, but in reality it's so reciprocal. You know, you show up and there's all of these people who show up for each other and these conversations happen and people are just so ambitious about being there for one another. And that's the beauty of it. You know, I think we have to get back to realizing that showing up for each other is what matters. And community-based programming is a way to allow that to happen, because we have a long time before there's going to be a national infrastructure for mental health.
And we're honored to have you. This has been absolutely amazing. And thank you for coming, and thank you for challenging us.
We definitely have to go back and revamp our email now and take out the part about the closet, because...
no, I hope you guys have that like on your site somewhere. So I'm going to say it right now then. And if you guys edit this out, I'm going to be so disappointed, because...
No, we'll keep it.
It was so much fun. So when you guys approached me for this, I was like, yeah, of course I'll do a podcast. I mean, and it's funny because, you know, you say you're honored to have me, but the cool part about this journey for me is that, you know, you invite me to have these cool conversations. I get to meet awesome people. I get to talk about things that matter to me. And you always learn more from the people you're talking to, right? It's anytime you think you finally learned it all is when you should just quit. And what I learned from you two is that you thought I needed to go lock myself in a closet to do a podcast with you. And well, I have it right here. Wording ever. So I'm sitting here going through this email that I received, and short of it already being mind-blowing, because very rarely do I get emails from anybody else named Kendra. So right away, it was already great. But I get these tips for how to prepare to do this podcast. And tip number 3, which is even funnier, because you gave me 5 tips and numbered them 1, 2, 2, 3, 4, which was not good for my, which was not at all good for my OCD.
But we've never claimed to be professionals. Okay.
No. It was a good test. I just sat there and read it a few times and went, wow, I got to fix that. I've got to fix it before I read it. But number 3, which is actually number 4, told me to get into a closet that had soft clothes to absorb the sound reverberations. And I was trying to think of the last time somebody had told me that I should stay in the closet. And it's been a lot of years since I've been in the closet. So I refuse to do this podcast from a closet, but I will forever be grateful for that instruction.
Our guests have mainly been our friends, because we're like a new podcast. So we haven't had to send this email to many people. So that's probably explains the typo. And so we didn't actually really think about it.
Well, and really, I want to know what kind of friends we have that let us send that email without telling us about the number error.
I don't think we've sent it out yet. I guess since we are going to hopefully be recording with more diverse guests, perhaps we should rethink the in the closet, because I didn't actually think of
the possible connotations
of that email. Yeah. So we don't want you to be in the closet. We want you to be absolutely yourself.
Be on your podcast. I got it. Yeah.
We meant more the physical in the closet. We accept you as you are. Yeah.
It was good anyway, because I can't even fathom like... And there's for so many reasons. Could you imagine how many people would struggle with being shut in a closet for over an hour?
Mental health issues.
I am recording in my closet right now. I record in my closet.
And you're entirely comfortable with that.
I am. Well, it gets me away from my kids and my husband.
Okay, see? It's motivated. So now you're leaving out half the details, which is actually you're hiding in your closet so that you don't have to parent.
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's a different, that's
totally
different.
Different story. But
wait until you find like the people who have like severe anxiety around claustrophobia.
You're going to send them this.
They're going to be like, I can't do their show because I can't sit in a closet for an hour.
That's right. We'll be like, optionally, you may sit in your closet.
It's funny. It's a first. I mean, I've done a lot of podcasts and I've never heard that before.
You guys are doing a great job.
I'm just somebody who likes to notice the little things.
Well, we appreciate you doing this podcast. Thank you so much. Bullshit. Thank you so so much for listening to us. If you enjoyed the podcast, or even if you really, really hated it, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It's how we're going to keep this podcast going, and we'd really love to keep delivering podcasts to you every week.
And you can find us on Facebook at Crazy Bee Podcast, Instagram at crazybitches.podcast, and on our website at www.crazybitchespodcast.com. Thanks for listening, Crazy Bitches. We'll see you next time.